First of all, a linguist is someone that loves language, has attention to detail. I think for them to succeed at Unbabel, they have to like AI and believe that AI is part of the future that is coming. Because if you're in denial, then you won't be happy. But understand the limitations of AI, and that AI is only as good as the knowledge that we give them, and that knowledge comes from them. So kind of see AI as an extension. Yeah, and again, it has to be someone curious. And one thing that I'll say about linguists, but mostly linguists and also translators that work with Unbabel, not the freelancer, but at Unbabel, they have to be willing to change the status quo. I remember I always had a lot of discussions with people at Unbabel that say, guys, if you're telling me that the solution to get more quality is to hire better translators, then you're not doing me a favor because everyone knows that. And yes, that is a solution. What we're trying to do is find another solution that can also work. Because guess what? You can scale the amount of translation that is needed just by relying on professional translators. That has been kind of like the mantra since the beginning.
Following is my conversation with João Graça, CTO of Unbabel. We talk about how his individual values align with those of Unbabel and how that has helped them build a company with over 400 collaborators worldwide and incredible innovations like Tower LLM. Enjoy.
I'm João Graça. I'm the proud father of the three girls. I'm from Portugal, Lisbon, Portugal. And I guess my background, so I did my undergrad in computer science. Indeed, I did my PhD in natural language processing and machine learning, working a lot with supervised learning, machine translation, almost like 20 years ago. And then after that, I was doing that in the US, in Philadelphia, at UPenn. Then I came back to Portugal. And one of the things I did is I started the machine learning summer school. So the idea was me and the other two co-founders wanted to kind of raise the level of people in machine learning in Portugal. It was still kind of like a niche area back then. And that has been going very well. It's still going after 13 years or 14 years. And at the same time, I met Vasco, the CEO and co-founder of Unbabel. And we start working together on another startup that was basically doing news recommendations. So we're still doing the machine learning part and LP, but on a different topic. That ended up not working very well. So we left. We joined another startup, basically also on recommendation space, so doing AI. All these early startups were always part of like the initial team where we met the other co-founders of Unbabel. That didn't work out as well. But we realized that we really, really like to work together. So we decided, okay, we want to do something together. And we had this passion for language, AI, how can we bring these two topics together? And I remember like at the same time that we're discussing ideas, we had this friend that was renting a bunch of houses in Airbnb, and he was struggling. Whenever he had people coming from Germany, he didn't know what to do. He couldn't communicate by email. He didn't trust Google Translate to just translate and send it. And we started thinking about the problem and say, well, why don't we just take machine translation because it's, you know, the quality is getting better, and we get some people to actually look at the translation and making sure, is this okay or not? We were not even thinking about correcting the translation. We're just like, can I send this or not? And then it kind of evolved to, okay, they can also correct. But one of the things that was different was, well, but instead of relying on professional translators, because we want this to be very fast and it has to be cheap because it's like low friction, can we use bilinguals? So people that speak the two languages, like I wrote my PhD thesis in English. I'm not a professional translator, but I could do it. I wrote a bunch of papers. And for that, what kind of tools we need to provide to them? So we start looking a lot on research that was being done back then on option-based MT. So we had a machine translation and you can click a word and see some options. And yeah, so that this like continuation of like research, academia, getting into the industry was what led to Unbabel. And I've been the CTO of Unbabel ever since. So my biggest challenge professionally has been to grow as a CTO from a 5-person startup to a 400-person organization. And it's been very, very fun.
And that's a very, very exciting story, the one that you're mentioning, because in between, from 4 to 400, there are a lot of things happen. And I imagine there are lots of ups and downs. And we also imagine that a big part of what helps you move or keep going is the understanding of your personal purpose. And that's why that question is really important to us in this conversation. And of course, you're talking about 20 years ago, working on things that today people are just realizing they exist. Could you tell us a little bit about your personal purpose and how that align with the more technical aspects that you have chosen for your career path, and how that all ended up aligning with Unbubble and being now the company that it is, and the professional that you are today?
Yeah, I mean, I love solving problems, like hard problems. And I love AI. I think I love the promise of what AI can do, like how we can have systems that interact with us. And this was kind of like what led me to this situation. And during my PhD, I kind of got in love with translation. I mean, language is one of the things that set us apart from other animals. It's a very complex thing because it goes from the concepts that we have to verbalizing them. And so it's kind of like, you know, for someone who loves problems, NLP has a lot of very hard problems that need to be solved. And I kind of like, one of the things that fascinates me at Unbubble is the ability to solve a really complex research problem, which is translation. But at the same time, in an actual consumer scenario where people are consuming it, and that if we succeed, we can actually build a translation layer of the world. We can help people communicate despite their language, which is a huge problem that I would love to solve. So it's kind of this mixture of like, I can still wear my researcher hat in a problem that I love that has actually big impact for society if we manage to solve it. So it's kind of like very hard to not be engaged and wanting to be part of it.
And I imagine, of course, that in the process of growth for Unbubble, you have been attracted to other people that love solving problems. Can you tell us a little bit about your team and how some of those values that you have also translate into the Unbubble philosophy, to put it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I've been lucky to work with amazing people over the story of Unbubble. Some of them are still at Unbubble. Some of them have left to do other things. I think like both me and Vasco, the founders, were very curious. We love deep understanding of things. So we try to gravitate to people who like come from academia, work on academia. I remember that we're a very small team of 10, and we hired André Martins, which is the VP of research of Unbubble. It's like an amazing researcher by his own merit that has like a bunch of ERC grants. We got Paul Dimash, which is also like an amazing person, always thinking about the future. So we start getting this group of people like super curious and kind of thinking, how can we solve this problem from a different angle? Like what's the first principles? And I guess that part of our naivety about the industry and also our background and our curiosity led us to go to like some different solutions from what the ones that existed in the industry. Not of them fully successful, but kind of like, it kind of brought a fresh of new air to the industry.
And this sort of answers a little bit our next question, of course, and I can read between the lines what it is that you really like about Unbubble. And we're digging a little bit deeper into what the organization is about. Can you tell us about how is it inside? And you've tell us, you know, there is curiosity, there is naivety, there is an openness to solve problems. There are no preconceptions. There is a lot of originality. Added to this, is this, of course, I assume this is what you like about it, but are there any other things that you like about it? And more interestingly for me, is there something about this whole process that you discovered that you were surprised about as you were doing it? You were like, oh, wow, I did not expect this was going to happen, but it's a good or bad surprise, up to you at this point.
Yeah, I mean, so to answer the first part, you know, there's a lot of values of Unbubble that I like a lot. One of them is like no politics. I would not be able to work on a company that has a lot of politics. It's completely against my principle. And the other thing, which is we care about each other. So we go out of our way to help each other inside of the company. And that, you know, at times that might not be the best thing to do just in terms of like the company performance. But I think it's what we as founders are, and me and Vasco, and we push to the company, and I think it's something that makes me very proud. The way, so we're very human. In terms of learnings, I mean, I think I haven't stopped learning. Like in the beginning, we're very naive. You know, we kind of thought, well,
you have machine translation and you put a human to look at the errors, well, now you're going to have quality. That was obviously not true. The other thing is kind of like translation is, the reality of translation is not what you learn in academia when you're doing research, where you basically have a data set with sentences that you translate. You know, every different type of translation is a different problem. So if you're doing like a marketing content has a very different type of challenges than translating an email. It has a lot of different challenges if you're translating subtitles. And one of our learnings in the beginning was we start saying, well, we have an API, kind of like a translate API, and now we're going to do everything. And realize, well, if we're going to take this path, it's impossible to have a product that solves the problem. So you ended up being a service company because there's a lot of manual work and scaffolding, because it's literally this very different. And that's kind of led to a significant change of Unbabel, which is, okay, let's pick one vertical and focus. And we start focusing on customer service, emails in the beginning. And so that kind of narrowed the problem, but allowed us to have a product that was super efficient. And so not only could we be like super efficient in terms of like cost, quality, and speed compared with everyone else, but even the operational work, like the project management work that we had, was much smaller because we deeply understood what were the integrations, everything that was going through. And then after that, it's okay, well, let's go to the other one. Is it marketing? Is it subtitles? And kind of this approach allow us to be very kind of efficient on the way that we do things. So that was also a big learning. I mean, there are several, like the difficulties of learning with markup was a very hard learning. But one I think it's kind of like the most important one is, what is quality? Like, no one really knows what's quality. It's an industry that everybody claims they have the best quality in the world, but nobody measures it properly. You know, it kind of took us out this long route of like adopting MQM as a framework, early days of Unbabel, hiring professional linguists to do annotation of MQM, working on a way to predict MQM with MQM QE so we can like scale this at scale, to basically have a way to talk about quality, because it's very difficult in the industry. Everybody claims that they have the best quality in the world. Nobody shows it. It allows for all kind of marketing that everybody can say whatever they want. And because of the origins of Unbabel, that we start with freelancers, not professional translators, and we ever since kind of have different crowds of different levels, people would look at Unbabel and say, oh, they're just post-editing, hence post-editing cannot deliver quality, which is not true. I think there's this assumption that if you want quality, you have three humans and one is a specialist, versus if you only have one human, you don't have quality, but you actually don't measure the quality. So there's kind of like these templates. And with the advance of AI, that's not the case. For a lot of use cases, machine translation already has quality. For the other ones, we need a specialist, but it's case by case. So this learning about quality has been a long process over the years.
And thank you for that. That's a really good nugget for us to talk about quality and briefly touch upon how humans are involved in this conversation. I'm interested in understanding a little bit more about that, especially the topic on how humans are integrated into the tech solutions that you have at Unbabel. And you have 400 people, so humans are involved everywhere. Could you tell us a little bit what the approach was? And you mentioned there was a bit of naivety at the beginning. So I assume in the past 20 years, the way in which you have approached or seen how humans are involved has evolved. Could you tell us a little bit about how it works right now at Unbabel?
Yeah, definitely. So an interesting thing is like really early on at Unbabel, one of our first employees was Elena Muniz, who's like a linguist by education. She did a PhD with me. She's now the head of the European Machine Translation Association. And we started having a bunch of internships with linguists. So we had linguists from the get-go at Unbabel, because we're using them to help us understand where the AI was failing, what needed to be improved, generating data. And one of the things that really annoyed us was when we're going to talk with the customer, and this is what kind of what happened in customer service. So we did some translations, and then the person did not understand the language. So he went to someone on the customer service desk that kind of spoke the language. It doesn't have to be native, just like kind of spoke the language. And they will show the translation and you say like, yeah, that doesn't look that good, or it doesn't look that native. Like, wait, but what is the problem? Like what? And it was that. It was a super ambiguous discussion. And so this can always have a lot of drawbacks. Like if the person was afraid of losing his job because they were starting to use Unbabel, obviously they're going to say there's no quality and there was nothing that we could do about it or improve it. And so we kind of set on this road to, okay, we need to have a proper way to discuss quality. And it was interesting because at the same time, we developed this kind of MQM notation tool. It was still not MQM that we're using with a different typology that we're using to train our AI algorithm to detect errors. We're already working on the sort of QE back then. And we kind of say, well, if we, instead of we change the typology to the MQM typology, and we actually add the number, we get the score. And we can go to the customer and say, listen, this is the score of the document. This is all the errors. Feel free to point where are other errors, but we can now start rationalizing. And so, and soon that became part of our culture. So we would talk with customers and show them reports of what we translated and say, okay, this is how we measure quality. Do you agree? But then we were like, okay, we need to scale this. And this is not like something that a translator can do. Like translators might not be equipped to do this kind of more deep linguistic annotations. And so since the get-go, we kind of have these different communities. We had one that did the translation, like the freelancers. We had one which is more the professional translators that we use for some content types. And then we have one with the linguists, which originally were mostly PhD students or people that already had a PhD that went through our personal networks that would work as freelancers as well, doing annotations for us. And this is still the case. This is still how we're developing the different communities at Unbabel. And I don't think that anytime soon we're going to stop needing them, because they're the ones generating the data that allows us to train the models. They're the ones creating the data. Actually, they're the ones giving us a lot of ideas of how to improve the processes. And interestingly enough, and I know we're going to probably talk about this in the future of our conversation, with the advent of LLMs, you stop needing a research engineer to do a model, because building a new model might be write a really good prompt with a lot of domain knowledge that does a task. And guess who's building a lot of interesting models at Unbabel? The linguists. So, you know, they're kind of like they're the new cool kid in the block somehow, which is super interesting. So yeah, so that's definitely a lot of part of Unbabel. We have a lot of linguists on our in-house team, but we rely on freelancers, linguists to actually do the annotations. So there's a difference between the people who do the tasks, translation or annotation or glossary creation, which are always freelancers, and the linguists we have in-house to basically our own quality assurance, generate test sets, help us understand the problem better.
And I think I can read between the lines. You're saying a good linguist is someone who can help understand the problem better. What are some of the other traits that you, and you're a linguist yourself, I mean, you've studied as a linguist. I wouldn't say a linguist, you tell me actually, but what makes a good linguist for Unbabel?
So a couple of things. So I studied machine learning because I was an NLP, I was exposed to linguistics. And because where I did the PhD, I did a PhD at UPenn at IST, and in both places there was this kind of like computational linguistic side that mixture in a lot of events, linguists with a more technology background and machine learning more from NLP. And so we worked a lot together and we learned from each other. And I think that is super powerful. I think so. First of all, a linguist is someone that loves language, has attention to detail. I think for them to succeed at Unbabel, they have to like AI and believe that AI is part of the future that is coming. Because if you're in denial, then you won't be happy. But understand the limitations of AI, and that AI is only as good as the knowledge that we give them, and that knowledge comes from them. So kind of see AI as an extension. And again, it has to be someone curious. And one thing that I'll say about linguists, but mostly linguists and also translators that work with Unbabel, not the freelancer, but at Unbabel, they have to be willing to change the status quo. I remember I always had a lot of discussions with people at Unbabel that say, guys, if you're telling me that the solution to get more quality is to hire better translators, then you're not doing me a favor, because everyone knows that. And yes, that is a solution. What we're trying to do is find another solution that can also work. Because guess what? You can scale the amount of translation that is needed just by relying on professional translators. That has been kind of like the mantra since the beginning.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And this is a perfect segue to talk about where Unbabel is today. So we have been discussing lately how Unbabel has released Tower LLM. And I say it so slowly because for me as a non-English native speaker, it's so hard to say LLM, Tower LLM, recently released. And beyond the marketing jargon, right? I want you to tell me about what makes this MT the best in the market. That is the claim that, of course, we are hearing from Unbabel, and I'd love to hear more about the details that you see there that make this happen.
Yes. I mean, so the reason why we say it's the best in the market right now, because this market is evolving very fast. And so I think that we're all going after each other, is we compared it on a huge test set. And it's the one that performs the best across domains, across language pairs. Intento did a huge benchmark with the public version of Tower. So Tower has two versions, the public one that we open source. It's on Hugging Face. You can go there and play. And then has an internal version that has more data and a slightly different training regime, which is the one that we use internally that has better performance. And it also got really good on Intento. And then with internal model, basically, if you look at the results in zero shot, it's the best in a lot of cases, second best in another ones, the best on average. And then when you add like a few shot or a rec, it gets the best performance. Now, why do I believe it became so good? I think it's LLMs are super strong. So LLMs have a lot of advantages. I'm going to talk about them. I think the first one is, if you just look at the zero shot, because then there's all the other pluses that I'm going to talk about, it's already very good. And I think it's very good because it's able to get these really powerful abstractions of words and translation and sentences. And so if you compare like ChatGPT, Llama 2, GPT-4, they're already very good at translation. Now, what we did was we intentionally trained it to be more multilingual. So it provided a lot of data from different languages that, for instance, Llama 2 doesn't have. And then we had a highly curated instruction set that we've done that basically makes it behave much better. So we're basically specializing, like we're giving an overwhelming percentage of instructions, super high quality, for translator-related tasks. The other thing that we noticed was because we trained for several tasks, like grammar correction, source correction, name entity recognition, translation, and QE, actually it became better on all of them than if you just train each one individually. And so that for me is like the biggest boost. And the reason we have this highly curated data set is part because of like the linguists that have been working with us for ages, like all the MQM data, but also because we have QE. And so even when we did the continuous pre-training, we could take a lot of data and just say, okay, keep this one, throw this one away because the quality is not good. And I think that was kind of like the secret sauce to get Tower to be as good as it is, because what Tower does right now is a 7 billion model that is beating like GPT-4, which is a 1 trillion model on these tasks. Not on the other ones, but on these tasks, it's actually beating all the other models. And I think that's a recipe that we're going to keep using. And I think it's the advantage from anyone working on localization is we have the data, we have the know-how, meaning we have the people that know to evaluate quality, predict quality, and we have the know-how to think, okay, how can we query the model in the best way possible? And then after that, and this is what I think it's coming next, and I think this is where a lot of times the discussion of LLMs versus LRMT is just focusing on the zero shot. I think what people are not discussing is like LLMs have one characteristic that I think it's amazing, which is you can pass it information in the declarative way, meaning I'm just saying, translate for customer A, and the style guides of customer A's are A, B, C, and D, and his terminology is like D, B, B. You can actually just write this. And then the model follows it. And it basically becomes customized to the customer in the way that you couldn't do before, because with Neural MT, what you could do is you could fine tune on customer data. It's a much more indirect way, much more expensive. There's no way to pass style guides. Like, you know, you just couldn't do it. And with LLMs, you can do that very simply. Now, we're all still learning what's the best way to prompt, like what's the size. There's still improvements going on, but as it is, it's amazing. And it opens the door to be much better than the models were before, much more. And this is just for translation, because I think there's much more than that.
And excellent that you're mentioning all these processes, because you're also really open. My microphone, Mila, it's looking orange. I don't know if you can hear me all right. I think you can hear me all right as well, Joao.
It's good.
Right?
It's good. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds it just perfect. Looks orange. It's weird. But Joao, it's very interesting that you're mentioning these processes, because it also shows that there is like it's ongoing. It's always moving forward. You did mention the multilingual aspect of it. Could you tell us a little bit more about the difficulties that you have encountered? And of course, I assume this is what sets you apart from other solutions. In fact, yesterday at the presentation at the conference that we were talking or that we were present at, they were mentioning how most models are distinctly not multilingual, and they are distinctly really clear to let you know very quickly that they are not multilingual, because it probably sets certain difficulties that others are not willing to tackle. You've said earlier that you love to solve complex problems. Could you tell us a little bit more about this multilingual element of it, of Tower LLM?
I mean, I think that for neural MT, it was just hard to make them multilingual. There are some multilingual models, but it was hard. So a lot of times, what we used to at Embevel is to have bilingual models per customer, like transformer models. That was kind of the best performing model. LLMs have the ability to be, because they have much more capacity to be multilingual. The reason I think that they're not very multilingual is not because they have a limitation, it was because the people who build them didn't care about multilinguality that much. So the data set that they were gathering was mostly English, like 95% English, like the training. So basically, the models got to be multilingual kind of by has a side effect, because in the training data, there was some parallel there and it learned some representations, which is different than saying, no, we actually want to pass information to the model in a way that he knows that these sentences are translations of each other and then train a lot on that. So a lot of the continuous pre-training is take a model that already exists, like a large language model, like Llama 2, Mistral, and then provide like a huge amount of data and start training on that data again. But on this data, you have data from different languages and you're explicitly saying, this is a translation of this, which is something that the other models haven't seen unless they saw it by mistake. And it's and sometimes it's like, imagine that you have two huge parallel data, like Europarl corpus. There's one thing to say, okay, here's the Europarl corpus in English, here's the one in French. Then for each sentence to say, okay, this is a translation of this one, this is a translation of this one. So the model just learns better that particular task. And so that was kind of like the building a model that was multilingual intentionally. So from the get-go, from the data preparation, how we feed the model, the order that we give the data, everything was made intentional to be multilingual. And this is described like the Tower public. They actually have like a research paper published that's going to be presented on September that is on archive. So people can go there and see. You know, Embevel has always been very committed to advance the state of the art. So most of our research is open source and published. And you can see there like what we did to make it multilingual and all those things. It was really like more on the intention than actually the models are the same. They're all kind of like a transformer based model.
Excellent. And we should be able to get some visibility on that paper once it comes out in September. Tell me a little bit more about the relationship with clients and how has that relationship helped Tower LLM be where it is right now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, we start with a lot with customer service clients. We've now been expanding to like all other verticals. And then basically, we're launching Tower LLM and making it available to them to start working. But we're not making it available as like a large language model that they can interact with, like chat with. It's mostly we're building applications on top of Tower LLM, so they can use MT that is supported by Tower LLM. We have their data to do, like we have their TMs to use on Fewshot, so you can query the TMs. So basically, instead of having a customized model for them, which is what we used to do, we use their data to fine tune the model. We can actually just do that via prompting and put their glossaries, and they can use a model like that. Pretty soon, they'll be able to use the model for automatic presetting, grammar correction. I'm excited to work with the customers in two ways. First of all, to see what other kind of information can we use to make MT better. But also, one of the things I think is like we can use Tower to do other tasks. And the question is like, what are the other tasks? So there's a couple of examples that customers that we're working on automatic transcreation, which is a really cool, it's a really cool challenge because it's something that was impossible to do before LLMs. So to give an example, we work a lot on customer service still. And if you're answering customer service for a Japanese customer, there's a lot of like cultural guidelines that you have to follow, that you have to adhere, that are completely different from if you're an English speaking person. So if you ask an agent to write in English and then translate and send it to the Japanese audience, it's going to be really incorrect. And it's like, it's not going to make them happy. Now, what we used to do before is we had these style guides, really complex, that we used to train the customer service agents that were replying in English and say, okay, if you're replying to a Japanese person, you have to write like this. And you know, they had to read it, they had to understand it, they had to obey by it. So it was not a perfect solution. Right now, what we can do is just we have our LLM, and we say, okay, you write in English normally, and then we have a button say rewrite, and it provides the same information, but now in a way that's culturally aware to Japanese, and then it translates. And so this is kind of like a new use case that our customers can take from the model. And what we're working with the customers, okay, what are other problems that you have that our LLM can start solving for you?
I think my next question switches gears a little bit. I mean, it's more related to history of Unbabel and Tower LLM. Of course, we all know about the Tower of Babel, and then we have Tower LLM, and then we have Unbabel. Could you tell us a little bit about the play of words that we have in there? Where do these words come from, and what's the intention behind all of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually an interesting story. So when we started Unbabel, again, you saw the small group. We were working on the office with another group of people working for a different company. And there was an afternoon that we spent the entire afternoon trying to come up with names for what's now Unbabel. And the best we could come up with was Vakrit, which is like the Nordic goddess of language, which in retrospect, it sucks as a name for a couple. At least we don't like it that much. And we went home and we didn't have a name. And the other morning we got there, it was written on the board to working like Unbabel. And we're like, well, this is amazing, because if Unbabel wants to build a translation layer, this is basically reverting the effect that the Babel Tower did. So the Babel Tower was built by God to make people speak different languages so they couldn't cooperate. And Babel was undoing that. And that guy was Ukuma Seru, who turned out to work with us for 6 or 7 years as our VP of marketing, still a very good friend. But unfortunately, we cannot claim credit for that. It was all his. He came up with the name. And I think when we're thinking about the name to give to Unbabel LLM, Tower, makes sense because we talk a lot about our offices and the company has a tower. So yeah, one of our principles is respect the tower, so the Tower of Unbabel. If you actually go to our office in Lisbon, it's a building called the Tower of Unbabel. And that's where the name of the model came from.
We'll definitely have to go to the Tower of Unbabel in Lisbon. I'm sure our team will be happy to do that. I'll be happy to do that next time I'm around. No one can tell the future, and I understand these questions are tricky, but the industry is changing very rapidly. We see a lot of fear, especially from the side of the translators, the interpreters, the linguists. In fact, yesterday I met a company that does instant translation and instant interpretation. They have no idea that our industry as a whole exists, meaning they do translations and interpretations, and they have no idea that there are conferences on the industry, that the industry is moving towards AI, that there are many advancements in technology. So the ignorance is bliss for them, but there are many that do know what's going on, and they are very afraid of what's going to happen. Most of us, of course, believe that humans that use technology and companies that use technology are going to have an edge. And that doesn't mean that linguists are going, or translators or interpreters are going to disappear from the ecosystem. That's just very naive to think. And your example is very critical and clear. You're mentioning that your team on Babel has linguists that are involved in the task sections of it as freelancers, but also others that are involved in the more complex tasks. Added to this, how do you see the future evolving in this whole tech human interaction and the industry as a whole?
I mean, I think it's so first of all, there's a lot of content that hasn't been translated yet. So I don't think we run the fear that there won't be work. I think the industry is going to become more AI first. I think the models are good enough that some content types don't require human involvement to translate. And when I mean to translate, I mean like on production, on the go, which doesn't mean that there aren't other works for humans. And I think that the amount of content that is going to be kind of machine translatable is going to keep increasing. And when I say machine translation, I actually like to refer as AI translatable, because I think that what we're going to see is that there's much more AI than just machine translation. So one of the things that we're playing with is, okay, you have machine translation, you have QE, then you can do automatic post-editing, but instead of doing a blind automatic post-editing, why don't tell it just like, these are the errors that can be found, and I'll solve them. And you can iterate on this a little bit. You can definitely correct the source text before you send it to translation. So you're going to start seeing these pipelines They have no human involvement. They're only AI, but kind of solve the problem. I think there's more of AI stuff. You're going to start seeing a lot of like AI generating the linguistic resources. For instance, like gathering and updating terminology by reading what's new from that customer. So you have like, you know, the website, everything, and you keep updating that. Once the terminology changes, it automatically triggers the curation of all the resources. You can have AI that basically understands what are the connectors, so the integrations, and for each content type decide, okay, for this one, I think you need this pipeline. For this one, I think you need this pipeline. So a lot of that work is going to be automated. And I think you're starting to see the beginning of that. I think there's going to be another trend, not just because of this, which is the centralization of content. And you're seeing some companies like Unbabel with the language operations platform, but also Lilt talking about this, which is the place where all the content of a customer comes. Because right now, if you think about a company, they have some content on HubSpot for marketing, for instance, some of them on Zendesk, some of them on whatever, but there's no centralized way that you can translate it. But even more than that, just kind of like guarantee you have the same style, the same things is a big problem. So having a centralized content platform powered by AI is going to facilitate a lot of this. I think humans are still going to be needed for like the training, the development. But I think one thing you're going to start seeing, and this is a new trend, so is basically a lot of agents. So instead of thinking about this module, you think about agents that interact with each other. So there's an agent that does a translation, and it can be super specialized for something. There's an agent that goes there and there's like a quality estimation for linguistic quality. There's another agent that does a quality check for regulatory style guides, for instance, for the medical domain. And then there's another, and there's all these different engines. And I think something that is really cool is kind of think about the professional translator, that he no longer does translation, but he manages a group of agents. So it's their agents. And basically what he does is he looks at the output of the agents are producing and he trains them. And by training mean, he gives supervision, he redefines the prompts, he launches the agents. It's kind of like, I don't know if you used to see Pokemon where they have like these different things that they train them. You can think about a translator to have a set of them. And so I think that for the ones that want to adapt to the new reality, the world is going to be amazing. For the ones that are still discussing that machine translation cannot do translation because of all the different reasons we've been hearing, they will be more cornered to like very specific niche places, which they still exist, but they won't be part of this next wave because it's kind of like you need to use this technology. It is too good to not be used. But I don't think I started by saying there's a lot of words to be translated because I think like the volume of words that are human translated hasn't decreased over the last 3 or 4 years, although machine translation is being much better. What's happening is something that we always said since Unbabel, that the amount of words that gets translated is going to grow exponentially, and the need for humans is going to grow linearly. And that is the only way that you can get everything that should be translated to have an actual translation layer translated. So that's why I think there's a couple of fear, but I think it's more like people need to be willing to adapt to the new reality. If they're not, yes, then they're going to be overcome by us, by people that just joined the industry right now. That, you know, the good thing about coming from outside of the industry, and that's what happened to us 10 years ago, is that you're not constrained by the self-imposed constraints that we put on the industry, which is really annoying. So that's a good thing. You'll see more good ideas coming.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Joao, for sharing your insights with us. And I think we'll need to have another conversation in the future. That's just a fact. Is there anything that you think we're missing in our conversation about Tower LLM, about the other technology solutions that Unbabel has that might be worth mentioning before we go?
No, I think we covered most of it. I think it's like QE is the really important thing for this translation task, like the ability to understand data, because most data sets are very polluted.
I would love to have another conversation and see how the world evolves, because I do believe that we'll see significant changes over the next year. But I think we covered a lot of material.
And that was our conversation with Joao Graça, CTO of Unbabel. I want to thank Joao for his time and insights. My name is Eddie Arrieta, CEO of Multilingual Magazine, and this was Localization Today. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.